Welcome to The Rink, your weekly source for hockey talk without the entitlement. I'm James Tapley-Gralian. This week, I'm talking to Eric Mackerlane from Off-Wing Opinion about the state of the Washington Capitals, and Jason Cohen, author of Zamboni Rodeo, about one of my favorite topics, minor league hockey. It's time to put the foil on. This is The Rink. I'm joined by Eric Mackerlane from Off-Wing Opinion, which, of course, is at offwing.com. Eric lives in the Washington, D.C. area. And, Eric, you get to see a lot of the Capitals from the press box, all around. And they're kind of a bit of a story right now. There's a lot going on with the Capitals, starting kind of with Alex Ovechkin, who's been out for a few weeks.
Six games.
Yeah, the upper body injury was.
So it was basically his left shoulder.
Yeah,
he heard it during a scuffle with Jason Chimara.
They were pretty secretive about that.
Well, I mean, no more secretive than George McPhee is about anybody's injuries around here. I mean, it's because it's Ovechkin. Obviously, there are a whole lot more questions being asked, but that's traditionally the way the organization runs under McPhee. Very, very tight lipped and, you know, not wanting to give anything away. So while it might seem like, you know, things are quieter than usual, it's just because it's Ovechkin. There's more attention, and you know, the team isn't operating any differently than it usually does.
Yeah, my curiosity kind of was in that whole Sidney Crosby, Alex Ovechkin, that there's always that you're in one camp or the other, and to kind of see how the injury bug was handled by those various camps. If it was the, whenever it was Sidney Crosby being injured, it was a media blitz and, oh my God, how is the team ever going to survive? And, I think that with the Capitals, it's been interesting because the team has survived okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's 1-4 of 6. Thing I guess is distressing is that, you know, on either end of those four wins were twin losses to the New Jersey Devils. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they're quickly becoming like, you know, the team's nemesis this season. I mean, they're 0-3 against them. But for the most part, you know, during the 6-game stretch, the team played quite well. And as a matter of fact, it seemed like, you know, in a couple of games, everybody was kind of, you know, coming together, pulling together to, you know, put the puck in the net. Never more so when they hung 7 on Florida last week. Mm. But, I think the thing to keep in mind is, you know, who's playing well in Ovechkin's absence. And, you know, I can't help but, you know, just like you compared it to when Crosby's out, you know, what's the team going to do with Crosby out? Well, when Crosby went out 2 seasons ago, you recall, it was Evgeny Malkin who seemed to come out of his shell and just, you know, take the team on his back and go on a rampage.
Right.
That's not exactly happened here. I mean, the guy that everybody was looking to, I mean, normally looks to, if you know, or I shouldn't say normally, because this is the first time Ovechkin's missed any extended time, playing time his entire career. But the person or the player everyone looked at was Alexander Semin. And he really, you know, didn't up his play in Ovechkin's absence. It didn't really matter that much because a lot of other players did. But now we're finding out that he actually had sustained a wrist injury. He's not with the team in New York tonight. So he may have been, you know, bothered by this for a couple of games now. It's only now coming out. But the guys who I think, you know, pull together and play well, there's 4 players that I think, you know, or maybe we could make it 5, you know, with Semyon Varlamov, the goalie, who's played very well of late. But I think of 4 players who played really well. Mike Knubel, who is plus 10, but is going to be out a couple of weeks with a broken finger. He had successful surgery over the weekend. Brendan Morrison, who is, you know, slid into a very comfortable position as the team's number 2 center. He's playing very, very solid overall around hockey, coming in like Knubel at close to a point-a-game pace. The other guy who's playing very, very well, a guy who started the season on the injured list but has come out really strong, is Thomas Fleischmann, who a lot of folks may recall was acquired before the lockout in the trade when the Caps sent Robert Long to Detroit in 2004. It's a deal that netted them, you know, a body that's since moved on, a draft pick that turned into Mike Green and Thomas Fleischmann. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and in limited duty, Fleischmann's got 7 goals all of a sudden. Apparently what happened was over the summer is he developed blood clots in his legs and he couldn't skate. Hmm. So he had to work on his upper body strength, and he came back with about 10 to 15 pounds more muscle on his body. So his play around the net has been really good. A lot of times you could see over the past few seasons, it was very easy to knock Fleischman off the puck. But that hasn't been the case so far this season. That, and there seems to be a new attitude. He's not afraid to cut to the net and stand in there and pounce on a loose puck and knock it in when he gets the opportunity. So he's played well. And then finally, I guess the fourth player, you know, up front that we got to talk about is Matthew Perreault, former MVP of the Q in Canadian Juniors, who's really turned into a third and fourth line spark plug playing center for the team, most often with Chris Clark on his wing, playing very, very well, scoring timely goals, really just a firebrand of a little player, works hard, he's quick, he's great on the fundamentals, good on the faceoff dot, and has been providing a lot of energy for the team in a very limited role. And on top of that, I would also look at Semyon Varlamov, who in his short NHL career has only lost once in regulation. Started the season a little bit slow, but the team seems to play with more confidence and more fire in front of him than it does in front of Jose Theodore. And, at the beginning of the season, Theodore was playing better, statistically, but he wasn't getting the wins. And meanwhile, Varlamov wasn't playing as well, but he was getting the victories because the team seemed to pile on the goals and he was playing. And now, again, that balance, that kind of, the balance in the tandem has changed again. Varlamov has raised his level and is playing very well. And it's Theodore who's proven to be a bit more, shall we say, inconsistent, which is something I'm sure you'll be familiar with.
Jose Theodore. It seems to rear its ugly head every so often.
Yeah. And, during Saturday's game, after Saturday's game against the Devils, he came in for some, I don't want to say rough criticism, but pretty direct criticism for Bruce Boudreau, saying that there was a couple of pucks that night that he should have stopped. And even Theodore himself admitted that, he's not playing up to the level that he's capable of, and he had to turn things on. So, lots of uncertainty in the team now, some injuries. Like I said, Knubel's going to be out a couple of weeks. We know Semin is out now. We don't know for how long. Apparently it's a wrist injury. But Alex Ovechkin will be back tonight in New York against the Rangers. And that's obviously, whenever you get your, two-time MVP back, that's going to be a pretty big tonic for the lineup. Be interesting to see how much energy and fire he plays, whether or not he's going to be throwing the body around the way he usually does, considering the injury that he's coming off of. But we'll see.
Yeah. You saw it, of course, against the Devils this weekend. On Saturday, basically, the Capitals got a 2-goal lead very quickly. In fact, I thought, "Wow, this is going to be a brutal night in New Jersey." And then it turns out that it was a brutal night, but the other way, the Capitals just seemed to kind of give up the gas after a while.
Yeah, it's funny. This is a question that got put to Boudreau a couple of weeks ago. And he, after a game against the Islanders where the team lost an OT, and it was Mike Vogel, who's the team reporter for, Capitals.com, WashingtonCapitals.com, put it to him. His first question in the postgame presser, he said to Boudreau, "It's just kind of, sort of like the season in a microcosm. I mean, you get up early and then you lose the lead." And Boudreau disagreed with him, but I didn't have any problem with the question Mike put to him. I mean, it really is. This team, going back to, two seasons ago, has a tendency of playing lights out for stretches. I mean, just terrific hockey, terrific offensive hockey. They pile on the goals. They get a lead. And then, I don't know whether it's, youth. I don't know whether it's discipline or focus. But they just seem to let off the gas and they let teams back into the game. And, maybe it'll be one goal at a time or, two goals at a time. I mean, we saw it, more recently against the Islanders, again in Washington last week. The Caps scored a goal 8 seconds in. Semin scored a goal 8 seconds in. Mm-hmm. And the Islanders scored 3 straight goals just all over them, the rest of the period. And And they closed it 3-2 and eventually won the game. Eventually won the game. But, you know, they do have that tendency. I mean, and even without Alex Ovechkin in the lineup, the Capitals ice a team that ought to be able to make the playoffs. I mean, they really do. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a team that's got more than enough talent up front and in net to be able to make the playoffs, even if Alex Ovechkin didn't play at all. And, you know, heck, you know, like I said, they won 4-6 in his absence against, you know, some weak competition. But, you know, anytime you win 4-6 and you're still basically, you know, near the top of the conference, you have to be happy. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people locally, a lot of folks locally who, you know, over the past couple of weeks have been expressing disappointment in the way the team's been playing. You know, they've identified, you know, problems with the power play, and they've identified, you know, defensive lapses and uncertainty in goal. You know, despite all that uncertainty, they're tied for first place in the Eastern Conference with the Devils. So, you know, while it's amazing what increased level of expectations can do to your perspective on a team. Because if you were to rewind 2 years ago, when the Caps were completely in the dumper, mm-hmm. to start the season, and you would have told a fan, well, 2 years from now, at the same time, 20 games in, fully a quarter of the way into the season, you're going to be at 28 points and tied for first place in the conference. I mean, everybody would be dancing a jig.
Yeah.
But now it's just you got a hypercritical eye on the team and its performance. And I think a lot of times people will lose sight of the fact that it's obviously not where you are at the end of November. It's the way your team is playing, the first week in April that matters the most. So, I think a lot of people are being too hard on the squad. Yeah, there are problems, but there's, still at this point 62 games to work them out. And I think reason for concern, especially over Jose Theodore, who, by the way, left the team in New York today to come back to Washington for undisclosed personal reasons. Mm-hmm. There's some reason to be worried, I think, about his performance going forward. I still think there's time to work it out and for this team to be competitive headed into playoff time. I think the biggest concern that folks should have about the Capitals is defensively.
Yeah, that's always my concern with that team.
Yeah, everyone knows there's a difference between your problems with your defense and problems with your goaltending. Mm-hmm. The Caps at one time or another have had both, but I think it's a case of the team playing consistently together defensively as a unit. If you were to rewind to last season, there was a game where the Capitals hosted the Canucks, and in the first period of that game, they held the Canucks to 2 shots on goal. Mm. Canucks, and that was a full-strength Canucks team with the Sedins and everybody else. And that's not a team that's impotent offensively.
It's no, not at all.
Solid core people.
The other day, what was it, 8-2 against Colorado?
Yeah. Mr. Henrik Sedin's turning into quite the goal scorer.
Without his brother.
His brother, on the shelf. It's kind of funny. We should get back. I won't go down that road right now, but we should get back to that and talk about the Sedins, being split up and what might tell us about them. Mm-hmm. But in any case, the team needs to stick to its system and execute it perfectly in order to play well defensively. And, more often than not, it doesn't do that. I mean, we're talking about a team that's given up 62 goals so far this season, a team whose penalty kill is, in the lower third of the league. That's not going to cut it come April. Mm-hmm. You need to have a penalty kill that's in the top 10. I don't know how you change that. A lot of folks, me included, think they still need a front line, primarily defensive defenseman on that blue line to solidify things. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen the last couple of teams that have won the cup. I think about the Anaheim team from 2007 and the rotation they had up top. And one of the reasons why you're able to win, and why, besides the fact that, Scott Niedermeyer and Chris Pronger were so good, is that both of those guys come playoff time, eat up a ton of minutes. Mm-hmm. And so somebody, including actually Steve Beauchemin, I think even averaged more ice time during that playoff year than Niedermeyer did. But when you got three guys eating up that many minutes and playing at such a high level, all of a sudden you've got a player like, you know, let's say on that blue line, like a Kent Huskins. Okay. You know, he goes from playing 17 minutes to 13 minutes. Kent Huskins is a much better player at 13 minutes a night than he is at 17 minutes a night. That's just the way it goes. If you know you're not going to be out there for as long because Pronger, Niedermeyer, and Boschman are going to be eating up, you know, 25-plus minutes a night each, then you know you can go out a little harder. You know, you can be a little rougher and put out a little more effort while, you're out there in limited minutes. That makes the rest of your team that much better, mm-hmm. When you're able to cut your minutes like that. So, I mean, I think the Capitals need somebody like that. I mean, any team, any coach, I'm telling you, would say they wouldn't mind having more sandpaper along the boards in front of the net, going both ways. And right now, the Capitals, they've got more sandpaper than they did last season because, it's clear to me that Brooks Laik and Thomas Fleischmann are more comfortable down low than they were a season ago. You see them going to the net more often. And Mike Knuble's there. Mike Knuble's still really the only player they have that plays with his back to the net. You'll see when they have him on the power play, he works down low the way a Tomas Holmstrom or Johan Franzen might work.
Yeah.
With his back to the goalie. When his unit switches out, it's more of an umbrella formation. Okay. Where, and you won't have those guys, and they play it's almost like they play tic-tac-toe more often than they put the puck on net. They're trying to basically, they're looking for the open net on the back door play more often with the second unit than they would with Knuble down low, where they're happy to throw the puck on net and, get a little sloppy and not going to rebound. So, I think they still need more of that grit up front, and more of that grit on the blue line if they're going to be successful come playoff time.
Well, your number one guy on the blue line right now, of course, is Mike Green. And he's right now he's got more points than Seven Morrison, Knuble, Fleischmann. But, he's definitely a offensive defenseman. People have always criticized that he's a defensive liability as defenseman, which I really don't quite see. I mean, he's an offensive
defenseman. He's not necessarily I don't believe he's necessarily a liability. I mean, he makes mistakes like any defenseman would make, but
right.
I don't consider him to be a liability. Again, I just don't think that there's a lot of grit when you go down. Now, recently Brian Pothier has been playing a lot better. Brian Pothier is kind of like a puck moving defenseman. He's not a rough guy, but he's been asserting himself more in the play and has been playing very well of late. The only guy who really, I think, lays the lumber on that blue line is going to be John Erskine. He's been hurt. He's been out of the lineup. Milan Drecina is a guy who, I feel about him the same way I felt about Victor Kozlov. So I've never seen a guy so big and so physically imposing, play the game without using that physicality. I don't know if you remember a college basketball player named Ralph Sampson, 7'4", from the University of Virginia. But every time he got out there, it looked like he wanted to be a point guard. And I'd see Victor Kozlov play, and every time I'd see him out there, He'd look like he'd want to be a center. He wanted to be a playmaker rather than, getting in there and mixing it up, using his size to, impress his will on the play and, knocking a couple rebounds. And, Jurchin has actually played all right. If you look at his plus minus, he's played all right this year. Played well in a lot of stretches. But again, I just don't see him, laying the hits the way I think he could. So they really need as I think John Buchagross has said it more than a few times. I mean, they need a guy on the blue line with a mean streak. And they need a guy on the blue line with a mean streak that's a mile wide to help improve things.
Well, I'm looking at the goal, the goal differential right now. And, you were mentioning that the Capitals have 62 goals against right now. And next up on the list, the next highest is actually the Islanders, who are sitting right now at number 7. But then you take a look at, the plus minus, which is not, it's not a great. We all know it's not a good statistic in general, but the worst plus minus right now is only -5 with Chris Clark, which really, you know, considering how many goals against right now, that's not that bad, is it? You know, which kind of makes me ask the question, you know, how's the special teams right now? How's the penalty kill?
Penalty kills in the lower third of the league. I mean, it could be better. It really could be better. I think one of the things that's maybe hurt the penalty kill this year has been the absence of Sergei Fedorov. You know, he only played 50 some odd games last year, but let me tell you something. When the puck was on his stick on the penalty kill, the man slows the whole universe down when the puck is on his stick. And I tell you, I think they miss him. I really think they miss him a lot on the PK.
I would. We were talking last year that, you know, here's a guy who not only is experienced, he has, you know, he's got the cup ring on his finger, but they easily slid him into defense when they needed to. And how many guys are you going to be able to do that with?
Yeah, that's for sure. So, yeah, I mean, Washington's penalty kill is 78.3 at this point. And that's, you know, the lower quarter of the league. I mean, they're at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's what, 23rd, 24th in the league? So, you know, that certainly could be helped. I mean, when Mike Knuble's out on the penalty kill, he's great. He's a terrific player to have out there. But he can't be out there the whole time. And, you know, they just, you know, and again, that speaks to having more grit up front. You know, you need more grit up front to be able to do well on the PK. And, you know, they don't have it, it seems. You know, I can't explain why, because there have been times when I've seen them on the penalty kill over the past several years where they're unbelievable, I guess, like any team. But it's just not where it needs to be. I mean, like I said, though, it's November. It's not April. So there's plenty of time to improve. And one of the things, you know, I've always, you know, seen about teams that eventually win is that every team, you know, at one point or another during the season has some kind of crisis of confidence. And they figure out a way to, you know, make it work. And I remember after game one of the playoff series between Pittsburgh and Washington last year, you know, one of the reasons why the Caps won that game was that they were so dominant on the dot, on the faceoff circle. And then I can remember, you know, in between games one and two, you know, what was it, Crosby and Malkin and everybody else just kept working on the dot. And they immediately took it from a weakness to the point where they were given as good as they got. You know, you figure out ways to, you know, solve your problems. I mean, obviously, and you can even look back to the point where, you know, it looked like the Penguins might not even make the playoffs last season before they, you know, got rid of Therrien and brought in Bosma. I mean, every great team has, you know, unless you're, of course, like the 78 Canadians, the 77 Canadians, you know, you have some kind of crisis of confidence somewhere during the length of the season, and you just figure out a way to fix it, turn it around. So, you know, there's still time to, you know, correct what's wrong. And, you know, now, and this is, I think, important to point out, is that it looks, you know, we don't have confirmation of this yet. We just keep hearing that it's going to happen. But Michael Nylander has cleared waivers. The Caps can now work out a loan deal to any other league in the world. And that will allow them to do is to take his, you know, more than $4.8 million of salary off of the books. And even though they're going to have to continue to pay him or work a deal with somebody. You know, be able to, you know, rejigger the team a little bit and fix what was wrong. I mean, last season at the trade deadline, a lot of folks in town wondered why the Capitals didn't go out and grab Bill Guerin. You know, clearly if somebody who was available for just a fourth round pick and, you know, obviously could, you know, do so much for you, why not, you know, give up something, you know, so insignificant when the Caps, you know, are famous for, you know, stockpiling late round picks anyway, or a bunch of picks anyway. Why not give up one and get somebody like Bill Guerin, who may be the difference between you know, losing the second round and winning the Stanley Cup. Well, I mean, one of the reasons why is, you know, salary. I mean, they would have had to figure out something to do with Guerin for this year, and they would have had to make some other moves in order to accommodate him on the roster, because they didn't have a whole lot of room against the Cap this year because of Nylander. But with Nylander gone, that you know, brings all sorts of other possibilities to the fore. First of all, you might see Carl Alsner who is a player who's ready for the NHL right now and has been ready for the NHL since, you know, I would think, you know, the middle of last season, to, you know, come up and, you know, get regular shifts on defense, you know, play in a second or third pairing, and maybe, you know, bolster that blue line core by getting some regular minutes. That's not possible with Michael Nylander still on the cap. So that may happen. You may even see, you know, John Carlson will probably get a couple of games this year. He's a guy who, you know, brings the lumber, brings the physical presence, and can play the point on the power play. They stole him a couple of seasons ago with a trade with the Flyers. You know, they got a first-round pick for Steve Eminger out of the Flyers for him, and late first-round pick, and were able to, you know, grab Carlson. So you may see some movement there. Maybe Matthew Perreault sticks around with the team a little bit longer. He's going to stick around a little bit longer anyway, because Boyd Gordon, who came, you know, back in the lineup after missing a couple of weeks with back spasms, you know, played not even one game, didn't even get through the game against the Devils, and, you know, is back out of the lineup again. So Perreault is going to be sticking around for a while, and obviously with that extra room, you maybe you can make that deal at the deadline now, the deal that you couldn't make last year.
Well, maybe, you also maybe mentioned Guerin in that, you know, you mentioned him in money, but at the same time, I mean, there are also people who have who look at that and say, okay, but does he fit with the team?
Oh, he would fit. He definitely would have.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, he had the, you know, he's got the presence to be able to make, especially last season. You think about, you know now with Knubel, you know, in the lineup, his, you know, his presence wouldn't be nearly as critical. But last year, when you got Victor Kozlov on the top line and there's a reluctance to mix it up down low, there's clear to me that, you know, if they had grabbed Guerin, he would have wound up on the top line with Ovechkin and Backstrom right away. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that you would have seen him line up on the right and play with those guys.
Is that how you – I mean, is that how you felt at the time, or is that kind of a hindsight thing? Because at the time, he was struggling in the islands.
Yeah, so. But it was clear that, you know, he still had the skill. You know, I mean, he was just playing with a lousy team.
Yeah.
You know, last year's Islander team was just a disaster top to bottom. And, you know, I could see any veteran who, you know, knows that there are fewer days ahead in his career than there are behind him, you know, maybe not being able to concentrate quite as much as he should and playing under par. You know, and it's clear that that's what happened to Guerin when he got to Pittsburgh. He was completely re-energized, and he's playing very well. I mean, he would have been a nice addition for the Caps last year, but they just couldn't find the room for him.
How have the Caps fans reacted to the whole Nylander situation? I don't know how I would have taken it if I had to sit and watch that much money, you know, sitting in the press box night after night.
Well, I mean, he's kind of an afterthought. I wouldn't say that anybody's really angry about it at all, because he started getting, you know, phased out of the lineup beginning with, you know, Boudreaux's ascension 2 seasons ago. So even though he was, you know, a lot was made of his signing. And let me tell you, Tape, I mean, nobody was complaining when he got signed. I certainly wasn't. If anything, everybody thought it was it was brilliant. It was what they needed to do, because they needed a center to play with Ovechkin. And everybody was saying, okay, we've got our frontline center now. And not only do we have that, we've got a frontline Swedish center who can mentor our young Swede, Nicholas Backstrom. And, you know, everybody thought that it was all going to work out. And it just turns out that, you know, once Boudreaux got here and he installed this attacking system, that all of a sudden, you know, a guy who's a puck lugger and, you know, who spends most of his time dipsy doodling, just didn't fit in anymore. You know, there was no logical place for him in the system. You know, Nylander did everything that Boudreaux asked of him, but Boudreaux just couldn't use him. And while there's, you know, I don't think there's no hatred of Michael Nylander that I can feel in this town. It's just, you know, he got, you know, phased out for the most part. The first season Boudreaux was here, he was, you know, a part-time player last year. And, you know, now it's just he never played in the preseason. He didn't get in the lineup, hasn't gotten in the lineup during the regular season. The only place he's played is Grand Rapids, you know, on that loan a couple weeks back. And he showed he, you know, still got some chops. So, you know, there's no overall feeling of I hate Michael Nylander here, especially since the first time he played with the team a couple of seasons ago, he actually played really well. He was like a point of game guy. But before he got, you know, traded in the Great Purge before the lockout. But, you know, I wouldn't say there's – if anything, there's amongst fans who know what the situation is and understand the impact and the ramifications for the team's cap situation, there's some frustration that this guy is still around.
Yeah.
And that they can't move him. But at the same time, nobody is saying anything along the lines of, you know, like the signing was McPhee's greatest mistake, because, you know – the fact of the matter is the last three seasons, you know, last two seasons, the team's made the playoffs and played some very exciting hockey. So the fans are happy. Okay. This is not like, you know, Long Island or Montreal, where fans, you know, lose their cookies if your team doesn't win a Stanley Cup all the time. All right.
Yeah.
I mean, so that the level of frustration that you might experience in other cities just doesn't come into account here, especially, I think, because there are just so many new fans here. I mean, the big joke was a couple weeks ago. I think it was during one game that went to the shootout. Ovechkin scored two goals in regulation and then scored a goal in the shootout. Everyone started throwing their hats on the ice. you know, that's not a hat trick, but, you know, the folks here, you know, too many of the folks here didn't know that. So away went the hats.
Yeah,
so,
good enough, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of folks here who are brand new Caps fans and brand new hockey fans. So if you think, I mean, Ovechkin's only been here since the year after the lockout. He's brought the new people into the building, really starting two seasons ago. Hmm. So it's not like we're looking at, you know, a massive fan base that's, you know, chomping at the bit for a title and, you know, is dealing with decades of frustration. There are people in this town have been fans of this team for decades, and they're dealing with their frustration. But it's a small core of people who are surrounded by, you know, waves and waves of new fans in the building.
Well, I guess compared to the frustration of the past at times, it's probably a little different. Like, for instance, today on Puck Daddy, Sean Lay put out a list of the top 10 worst teams of the last decade, and clocking at number 7 was the 2003-2004 Washington Capitals.
That was just death warmed over that year. I can remember going to a game that spring. I had actually I had a get-together with a bunch of my of off-wing readers at the pub RFD right by the arena. And I can remember going to the game, and it was against Ottawa. So it was Peter Bondra's first appearance at Verizon Center in an enemy uniform. And of course, you know, everybody was rooting for Bondra to score in the waning moments. But it was a painful experience, because that was a building that had no hope in it. Hmm. You know, we were playing out the string on a terrible season. Any player that had any kind of emotional connection with the team beginning early that season with Steve Konowalczyk was moved out. Mm-hmm. Everybody, you know, or at least, you know, the fans who were in the know knew that more than likely we weren't going to have hockey the next season because of the lockout. So everybody was looking at, you know, down the pike and just didn't see hope for a long, long time. And as it turned out, you know, you add that 2003-04 season, the lockout, and then the two seasons after, that was four full seasons of misery, which, you know, for some fans isn't very long at all.
No. for some fans, that's a lifetime. But for some, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but if anything, I mean, it's almost like the plan came together a season early. You know, a lot of us thought that it was going to take one more year, but, you know, they got into the playoffs that year. I mean, that's the power of Ovechkin, I tell you. But, yeah, I remember the 2003-04 season, and it was as painful as advertised. I mean, you saw everybody who was worthwhile traded out of town. The roster was filled with a bunch of, you know, minor league journeymen and nobodies who didn't want to be in town and nobody wanted to see play anyway. The only recognizable face left on the team at that point was Ole Kolzig and really Jeff Halpern. So yeah, it was a tough year. It was tough hockey to watch. Yeah.
Well, Eric, thanks a lot for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Hey, anytime, my friend. Always happy to.
So that does it for part one of my talk with Eric Mackerlin. You can find part two later on in the week, and you can always find Eric's writing at Offwing Opinion, his website, which is at offwing.com. Earlier in the week, I met with Jason Cohen, author of Zamboni Rodeo, and we talked a little hockey at a hockey game. Enjoy.
Now, from the background noise, you can probably tell we're at a hockey game. Right. Spokane Chiefs taking on the Kamloops Blazers. It's the second intermission and of a 4-1 blowout, but I think even it could be even worse than that. And I'm lucky to have gone to the game with Jason Cohen. Jason wrote Zamboni Rodeo, which I think is the best book about minor league hockey. You followed the Austin Ice Bats of the Central Hockey League around for a year, rode the bus with them and all of that, and wrote about the experience. What was the experience like for you?
First it was just unexpected at the time. Like, what is this all about? You know, hockey in Texas, really? You know, and that's what everyone would always say. And, I didn't know, like, that the world even exists. I mean, we're here in Spokane. You know, there are players on the ice here that are NHL draft picks. You know, they still have a chance to move up. But what happens to the rest of them? You know,
right.
And I found out that a lot of them come down to Texas, you know, where they can fight and still score goals and have fun doing what they love to do for a few more years at least.
And people are always amazed to find out that Texas has the most professional teams, hockey teams of any state in the U.S.
Are we still hanging in there? Well, certainly of any state, yeah. I mean, I always used to say any place in North America, you know, counting even the provinces, because they don't have pro hockey really in Canada. They have this hockey, major junior, you know, so... So, yeah, they probably can't compete with Alberta or whatever. But, yeah, I guess Texas is still, even with all the changes, you know, they still must have double-digit teams. Yeah. So, yeah.
And now you're up in Montana, and so you get to see a lot of the WHL, which is Canadian juniors. And like you said, a lot of people who are drafted. It's good, solid hockey.
Yeah, I spent a little time in Portland, a little time in Vancouver. I really, you know, the WHL... It really is the feeder league for the hockey that I got into in the minor pro. It just so happens a lot of the coaches and recruiters in Austin, you know, were British Columbia guys themselves, Alberta guys themselves. So there's that big divide, you know, between the OHL and the WHL about what kind of players, you know, these are the gritty, rough and tough players, and the OHL are the, you know, fancier players. And Quebec, I guess, even fancier still, right? So there's always that culture clash. But yeah, I really, the WHL's, you know, it's a little more fun even than minor pro, because you get the, you know, the crazy passionate fans and the cheap tickets, but you still get some NHL caliber talent, you know, when they're 17, 18 years old.
Yeah, now, I know you mostly as a minor league hockey guy. You know, and taking a look at the changes that have gone on in minor league hockey over the last couple of years, you had, you know, a couple of teams in the ECHL folding halfway through the season. The fall of the UHL and it basically turning into kind of a six-team, I wouldn't say joke league, but getting close to. What do you think of the state of minor league hockey right now?
Well, it's always been in flux, you know. It's always been a gamble to have so many teams, you know. People used to have more money. I mean, I think the slower decline of it over the last 5 or 6 years, pretty much ever since the internet age and the first, you know, economic slump, you know, that's when the real heyday ended, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of it is what they would call a market correction, you know, where it just takes some time to catch up. It's the nature of the beast. I mean, it is weird. Like, the WPHL, which became the CHL, I mean, that used to be kind of a Texas league. You know, that's how it started. And now there's teams in South Dakota and, you know, Colorado and Arizona and Missouri now, I guess, just opened yesterday, right? So yeah, and then, of course, the other thing about the CHL is the team in the CHL was always the Oklahoma City Blazers. And, I mean, we're sitting here in Spokane, and the coach of the Blazers, the Chiefs, rather, is the former Blazers player whose uncle, Doug, was the Blazers coach, Hardy Sauter. I mean, it's just a 20-year institution that just went away all of a sudden, you know, overnight, just, what, 2 months ago.
Yeah, lease problems and all that. Was this the same coach that had the walrus mustache?
Yes, they call him the walrus.
And bit a horse on his ear to get him to stop
He's
charging.
He's like a horse whisperer, yeah. He used to be a puck whisperer, but, you know, they haven't won a championship in quite a while. So
your favorite team, the one that you wrote the book about, I kind of assume your favorite team, the Austin Ice Bats is no more.
Yeah, and they went away too. I feel like they got called up, you know? I mean, there's a lot of people that are upset because it's a different experience as a fan. I mean, the same way people are always saying that Portland and Seattle would be great NHL markets, and they don't really stop to think about the fact that the 7,000 people that come and support the teams now, they don't want an NHL team necessarily. They can't afford it. You know, they're not going to get to cook dinner for the players. You know, the fan club experience, the whole thing's different. So that's what was so great in Austin. And so there are people that are not going to embrace the AHL because it's more itinerant. You know, players don't stay longer. They get called up, so they're not around. You lose them. That's always a hard thing when you follow minor league hockey. You know,
it's kind of like college hockey in a way, in that respect.
Yeah, well, college hockey has the, you know, the go team sort of, you know, the loyalty of alumni, the loyalty of students, you know. And this, the Texas Stars, I mean, they're coming in. They have to, you know, start all over kind of. You know, and they've won over most of the Ice Bats people at this point, I think. But it is weird to think they're not there.
Yeah, and that league actually has been one of the more stable ones compared to, like I mentioned, the UHL. Of course, it wasn't all that long ago that the IHL, the original IHL, folded, and all of its teams had to be split up between the AHL and the ECHL. It's not, you know, and the way the economy is going right now, it doesn't seem like there's going to be even this many hockey teams next year.
No, there's always a decline, it seems like, now. But, I mean, the CHL, it's stable, but, you know, it's only stable because they keep bringing in new markets. I mean, if you made a list of all the teams that ever played in the WPHL and the CHL in 1998 versus now, yeah, I think you'd have more teams that are gone than there are around still.
Now, you live in the middle of Montana.
At the moment,
yeah. And you're a big hockey fan, and you have a kind of a low junior team.
Yes.
There. So how is it to be a hockey fan in, you know, where there's no minor league hockey nearby? There's, you know, you have to drive, what, 5 hours to get to a junior team?
Well, it's 3 hours to here, yeah, from Missoula to Spokane. So Spokane is my closest, you know, team right now. You know, I mean, well, there's television, of course, you know. There's always, well, not versus because they have DirecTV, but there's NHL hockey and college hockey. And I mean, I learned the Missoula Maulers are in the NORPAC division, the NORPAC League, Northern Pacific, and it, you know, it's kind of high school hockey. I mean, it's lower level junior hockey with 17, 18, 19-year-old kids. And, I mean, the experience has all the same things that I love about minor pro hockey. I mean, it brings the community together. They're all really passionate. They're all really supportive. You know, there's no barrier, really, between the players and the fans, and that's all cool. The play, you know, I mean, I'm not a snob about level of play. You know, I mean, a lot of people, still, I think even in the blogosphere, when, you know, what do we call it? The Twitter sphere? The tweet sphere?
Twitterverse, I don't know. Or something.
Yeah, the tweet of the Twitterverse. All right. A lot of NHL fans, I think, are, you know, snobbish about minor league hockey. They want to see the best players in the world, you know, and that's all they're interested in. You know, the minors offers a different kind of experience. And I know that the Ice Bats, people would watch them and be like, ah, you know, the play, it's just not very good. You know, they can't put the puck on, you know, on the tape, or, oh, I could play at that level. Well, you can't play at that level.
No.
I mean, these are still, you know, really experienced professional hockey players, you know, who played in the junior system in Canada and are fairly talented. You know, they, just because they're the 973rd best defenseman in North America instead of the, you know, 60th, you know,
yeah,
that's still pretty good, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, watching some of these kids in Montana, I did learn there, you know, there is a limit to some extent. It is like watching kind of, you know, a small high school football program or something.
I wanted to ask you a little more about Zamboni Rodeo, the book. You spent a whole season on the bus with the team, riding around, going to the games in the locker room, and kind of having that, you know, having an experience that, you know, I've never had. A lot of, you know, people who haven't played the game don't ever get the opportunity to have. I mean, what was that like as an outsider?
Well, it wasn't glamorous, certainly. their life isn't glamorous. So we, you know, a lot of bus breakdowns and sleeping for 10 hours on road trips and bad food and stuff. And so you really appreciate kind of how much they want to play, you know, that, for what they put up with. I mean, they put up, I mean, I always say Slapshot is a documentary. I mean, I can't, you know, can't do any better than that, really. That movie nailed it. You know, they nailed that world then, and it hasn't really changed that much in terms of the owners, the pressure, you know, all the crap that you put up with as a player. But obviously for me it was fun, and, you know, I didn't have to go out and play either, so I was not quite as tired as the rest of those guys. But, yeah, it was crazy. I mean, it was crazy to go to all these towns and meet these fans and sort of realize how interconnected the universe is. Even in this building right here, I'm sure we could, you know, we could go down to the locker room right now and you know, talk to five guys on one of these teams, and they'd all be like, oh, yeah, you know, guy from my town played for the Austin Ice Bats, or, oh, yeah, my cousin, you know, is in that league. And, you know, it's that little Canadian universe of pro hockey that they just go where the jobs are, you know.
The Bat Cave where they used to play. I mean, that was a barn. That was just a sheer.
It was
old
literally a barn.
Barn.
Yeah, I mean, it was a rodeo. That's where they had the rodeo every year. They used to get kicked out every year for the rodeo. You know, and they that hurt the team too. They used to go on these 3-week road trips and, you know, blow games right before the playoffs would start. But, you know, but priorities. People would always complain. It's like, well, you know, come on, we're in Texas. I mean, who do you think comes first?
Yeah, I think the game I saw there were probably 1,000 people there for a Sunday afternoon game. It was I skated on the ice afterwards. Yeah. It was actually the worst ice I've ever skated on. I can't imagine how NHL players would be, you know, they'd be complaining a lot about the ice in situations like that.
I mean, all you can do with that is make it part of your game plan, I guess. You know, hope that the other team doesn't adjust to your crappy ice, you know, the same way people do with less than regulation size. I noticed, by the way, here in the Spokane Arena that they don't have a Zamboni. They have an Olympia ice machine. Don't always see that, you know, sort of heavily promoted.
That's true.
Like who wants to ride the Olympia ice machine? All due respect to the fine Olympia ice machine company.
The fine makers of but Zamboni's still, you know, made in the U.S. still
true
down California. In California.
It's
amazing.
Well, it's like Kleenex. I mean, actually that was an issue for me when I wrote the book, is I had to talk to them and, you know, get permission to use their trademark, because they don't want that word to become generic, you know. They don't want people to look down at the Olympia ice machine and go, oh, look at the Zamboni. They want, you know.
I don't think they have much of a choice in that. I don't know anybody who says, look at the ice resurfacer.
No, right, of course. Yeah, yes, look at the generic brand name ice resurfacer. Yeah. No, but legally they have to fight that battle. You know, they have to keep it up.
You have the other snobbery that I think you find a lot of times with hockey fans just in general is, you know, we're a certain type of fan, they're a certain type of fan, and people like to kind of laugh at the Texas hockey fan or even the Southern hockey fan. Do you really find a lot of difference? I mean, do you find that there's a Texas brand of hockey?
No, it's just a matter of scope, you know. I mean, I'm a Flyers fan, and so when I'm on the Flyers message board, there's always arguments about all the same things everyone else is talking about, you know, Phoenix or, you know, Carolina, or, you know, whether Tampa, whether there should be teams in those markets, you know, struggling markets. Well, you know, it's not a birthright. I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah, you know, Carolina is never going to have more fans than New York or Chicago or even Denver, you know, where snow is natural and there's more history. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's just, you know, if the business can sustain itself, I don't think hockey fans really appreciate how few dedicated fans actually make up a fan base. You know, I mean, this is a business, an entertainment business, and group sales and individual tickets and marketing and promotion. I mean, that's what fills your arena every night for 80, you know, is it 84 now? 82 games a year. And, you know, it's great when you're in Toronto or Montreal and you don't have to even worry about that stuff, really, because, you know, everyone's going to go. But, you know, if Carolina can survive in Carolina, you can't tell me that those 12,000 people that regularly follow the Hurricanes are any, you know, less passionate or less intelligent as hockey fans than 12,000 people in Chicago. It's just that there's only 12,000 of them.
Right.
You know, and I think that's true in Austin, and it's true here. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, here we are, and, you know, nobody thinks about Spokane or Seattle or Portland when they're talking about hockey's popularity on TV or whatever. But,
right.
But all these markets count.
Well, you know? These guys have a lot harder, you know, these fans have a harder time following their team. They don't get necessarily, you know, a solid television package, get to see the out-of-town games. You know, the coverage for the minors especially is a lot more difficult for these fans to follow.
Well, the internet obviously has changed that to some extent. But yeah, they're never going to get, you know, the same thing that an NHL fan is. But what I mean is, you know, come May, depending upon what's going on in the Memorial Cup, you know, these 10,000 people are part of Versus' ratings for NHL playoffs, you know, and sometimes we only think about the big markets, you know.
Well, the Spokane Chiefs are about to take the ice again, as you can probably hear in the background there. You're rocking the Central Hockey League All-Star jersey.
I guess it's the last game I went to. It was in New Mexico. They were having the jersey auction. It wasn't very well attended for some reason. Well, what happens is because the league's so diffuse, you know, you got your Northern Conference and your Southern Conference. So most of the fans that get to travel to an All-Star game are from the home conference. You know, the ones from the visiting conference that's farther away. There's probably only going to be 70 or 80 people there. So they're having the jersey auction, and they're rocking all the, you know, home team jerseys and the Southern jerseys and whatever. And then they got to the North, and it was just kind of slow. And the jersey I'm wearing belongs to Hardy Sauter, who's pretty much the best offensive defenseman ever to play in the Central Hockey League, and probably Double-A hockey in general. You know, just a great point man, great scorer. And like I mentioned, the nephew of Doug the Walrus Sauter and the head coach of this Spokane Chiefs team. So I don't think I would have bought anybody else's. It's not like I was a huge fan of him or the Oklahoma City Blazers, but I was like, well, this is crazy. You know, I'm sitting at a jersey auction. Here's the All-Star jersey, possibly the last All-Star jersey, you know, autographed of one of the greatest players in league history, and nobody's bidding on it.
Yeah.
So I said, all right, you know, I'm going to do it. And so at least I had something to wear tonight.
Oh, it's a great jersey. What is I've been asking this a lot, and I guess what is your favorite jersey that you own overall?
Well, it would have to be, even though they're all just hideous, it would have to be my Ice Bats jerseys from the year that I covered the team. And I mean, like any team, they had a horrible tradition of alternate jerseys and special event jerseys. One that I do not own, but I write about in the book, is the infamous Christmas jersey, which actually had wreaths and Santa beards on the front. And those were just a nightmare. But I have one. It's kind of just a goofy-looking red, white, and blue Ice Bat that's signed by one of my favorite players from the book, Keith Moran, who was this college kid, kind of a, you know, kind of out of place, you know, just came down and tried to make, you know, the team and ended up sticking. Kind of, he'd kill me to say this, you know, kind of the Rudy figure, you know. I mean, he was actually a really good player. I mean, he wasn't that bad, but, you know, he definitely had that underdog quality, like, oh, is this guy going to stick? You know, he was the 11th forward out of 10, you know. He ended up switching to defense. That's how he changed.
Oh, wow.
So I really like that one. And the next year, again, hideous, but too funny not to get. They did what they called the Stevie Ray Bat, because Stevie Ray Vaughan's very popular in Austin, and, you know, there's a statue of him downtown. So they did a little ice bat with Stevie's trademark black hat. And so I have a game worn of that from, I think it was Tab Lardner, another good player for the Ice Bats at the time. So, yeah, so those are my prizes. They're all Ice Bats related, certainly.
Well, Jason Cohen, I really appreciate you talking to me, to come in and see a game.
Well, thanks.
Driving all this way to see a game with me, that was great.
Well, it's, you know, it's fun. I've always wanted to come to, you know, basically every city in this division, you know, in the WHL. You know, we still have the Tri-Cities, and then I've been to Seattle and Portland, obviously. So yeah.
So you're on Twitter, you're Zamboni Rodeo, all one word.
Yes.
Where else can we find you online?
Well, ZamboniRodeo.com, you know, if you want to revisit the halcyon days of the Ice Bats.
Which I did today.
Yeah, cool. Got good to prepare.
Oh, yeah. Right?
And sometimes CantStopTheBleeding.com, you know, another blog that I write for.
And Zamboni Rodeo, the book, still available. You know, I believe Amazon.com still, you know, playing places.
Pretty much used copies. It is technically out of print. So if you find one, you're either buying it used or you're getting it from my house. So.
Well, I recommend it because, I mean, it's an awesome, awesome minor league hockey book. You know, still probably top five hockey books of all time for me. So
thanks
a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for another edition of The Rink. You can always find The Rink at www.rinkpodcast.com, where you can comment on anything you heard here, listen to old episodes, or subscribe in iTunes. You can email us at rink@rinkpodcast.com, and you can always call us at 845-704-RINK. That's 845-704-7465. Thanks for listening to The Rink.